Cosmic Shed.
Hello, and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. We're going to hear from the professor of astrophysics at Harvard, who has caused the media to say that there might be an alien spacecraft travelling through our solar system right now. And we're going to hear from Apollo astronaut Alan Bean. Because this podcast is all about First Man, the film about Neil Armstrong. I'm Andrew, and with me today in the shed are...
Tishna.
And...
Ty, but it's been so long since we've done one of these, I have no idea what we're doing. How does this work?
We talk about... Well, I'm going to do it slightly differently this time. I want to talk about a bit of science first. There's a piece of news knocking around everywhere at the moment in the science world, the space world, about Oumuamua, the cigar-shaped interstellar object. First of all, we thought it was an asteroid, right?
Yes.
It was a big rock coming through our solar system. We saw it after it had gone past the sun. The problem was, you would expect a rock as it comes towards the sun to speed up, because it gets pulled by the gravity of the sun. You expect that to happen. I believe that happened. But then as it goes away from the sun, you would expect it to slow down as the gravity sort of pulls it back a bit. But it didn't. It sped up a bit.
So isn't that the slingshot effect? Wouldn't it whip it round and cause it to go at faster speeds?
Yes, for a little bit. But then at some point, the overwhelming gravity of the sun would slow it down. Mm. One of the first reasons why we knew it was interstellar was because it was already going too fast for anything within our solar system. There's, you know, the escape velocity of the Earth, 11.2 kilometers per second is what we need, the speed you need to be going at to escape the gravity of Earth. There's a similar speed for the sun. I have no idea what it is, so I'm not going to make it up. Really fast. Mm. And so almost everything, all of the planets and comets and asteroids and everything in the solar system is all below that speed. We're all trapped in the gravitational pull of the sun. But this thing was already going faster, so it was clearly an interstellar visitor rather than a solar system visitor.
Cool. And when they tracked it back to see where it came from, first of all, they thought it came from the constellation Lyra,
yes,
which we have to mention for two reasons. One is because that's the name of my daughter, and two, because I have interviewed the lead scientist on something called Project Lyra, which is, it's a paper at the moment suggesting ways that we could possibly catch up with Oumuamua to see what it is, send a spacecraft to it. I'll probably put that in the podcast later on. But first, there is another piece of news about Oumuamua. Well, the headlines say something along the lines of Harvard scientists, in some case they go as far as to say, Harvard scientists confirm that it's an alien spacecraft.
How could they possibly confirm this?
Well, they haven't.
It's funny, they can't.
They haven't. And in fairness to the scientists, they don't claim to have confirmed it.
Basically, this news kind of, it annoyed me a little bit, shall we say, politely. It annoyed me because I thought it was slightly irresponsible. I'm not sure who I'm more annoyed at, whether it's the scientists or the press release or all of the publications that covered it, including my own, Physics World. But yeah, it's this thing that basically what the scientists have said is, of the many, many possible things it could be in this universe, one answer is maybe an alien probe of some sort, more likely an alien sail. This is the idea that you can use some kind of radiative pressure, so whether it's from starlight, sunlight, or indeed a giant laser on your home planet, not called Starkiller Base, sort of pushing the sail into space. That technology I have no issue with, that absolutely exists. There's a Japanese mission that's actually already done that. So that exists. But it's this idea that, yes, this is some kind of alien space probe, which, you know, quite a poor probe, just sort of zipped past, didn't do anything, didn't probe us in any way, shape or form that we know of.
So it's just a cool-looking rock, is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Well, no, right. So the problem is, Ty, Avi Loeb and his collaborator looked at the data, and their reading of the data, using proper scientific methods, you know, the professor of astrophysics is not, it's not at that point, it's not crazy. Right?
Okay.
They've looked at it, and their reading of it is that it could be less than a millimetre thick. If it's less than a millimetre thick, it's clearly not a bit of rock. It's clearly not a comet. But is it less than a millimetre thick?
That's the thing, we don't know. The only way we can tell the shape and size of this thing is by the light that it throws off. And it throws off less light than one would expect. But that, to me, is not a good enough reason to just go, aliens.
So I have questions. So is it an alien probe? Like, is it here to contact the whales? Or is it a rock spinning head over heels? How's this thing moving? Is it moving like a probe or a spacecraft? Give me details, people.
I spoke to Professor Avi Loeb, who is the Harvard professor of astrophysics, who has put this paper together. Anyway, this is Avi.
What's surprising is that this object is weird and nothing that we have seen before. And it has an extreme shape from the variation in the reflected sunlight, factor of 5 to 1 or more in terms of the long axis to the short axis. It also sits in the local standard of rest of all the stars in the vicinity of the sun to within 2 kilometers per second. So only 1 in 500 stars is sitting at that frame so precisely. And, you know, it's sort of that's the frame you want to be in if you want to camouflage your origins, because then you cannot attribute the object to any particular star, because this is the standard of rest of the galaxy locally. And then, you know, this object is very cold. And the fact that we discovered it is surprising, because I wrote a paper a decade ago estimating how many rocks should we find in the interstellar medium that enter the solar system. And we ended up with estimates that are 100 to 100 million times smaller than needed to account for Oumuamua. So the fact that it exists means that you need of the order of 1,000 trillion objects per star to be ejected during the star's lifetime. And that's much more than the solar system is ejecting, you know, and objects of this size, of order tens of meters, 100 meters. And so it's surprising, even if it's from a natural origin, it's very surprising there are so many of them, if it's one out of many, random population. And of course, the trajectory that requires an extra force, according to the Nature paper by Michelli et al. That was the thing that triggered this latest paper that got the publicity. And the idea is that we don't, you know, you could get, in principle, you can get a push from a cometary tail when ice evaporates on the background, on the surface of such an object. In a comet, that's what happens. But actually, we don't see any cometary tail. And you need a significant fraction of the mass of this object to be evaporated in order to give it the push that is necessary. And also, such a push is accompanied usually with a change in the rotation period of the object. That's what happens in comets. And we don't see such a change in the rotation period. So it seems unlikely, very unlikely, that this object is a comet. And so the only other force I could think of is the radiation pressure from the sunlight. And then I suggested it to a postdoc that just arrived, Shmuel Bialy, and he was excited about it, and we pursued it and calculated that the object needs to be thinner than a millimeter. Of the size of 20 meters or more. Yeah, it's sort of like going to the shore, you know, and looking at seashells that were swept ashore, and you know, you look at all the seashells and one of them looks like a plastic bottle, and then you realize, you know, maybe it's artificial in origin, and perhaps in the context of the solar system, you know, we should just look at every object that enters that is coming from interstellar space. And that's one way of finding out whether we are alone or not. So the point is, this was not planned, the public aspect of it. And it's just like any other paper. If someone has an issue, then they should write a paper that suggests another explanation. And that, let's see if it's more plausible. If it is, and based on the evidence, then I will be the first to admit it. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And it's just that this object looks so weird to me that I have to say that, you know. Why should I tone that down if it looks weird to me? Just because people don't like me saying that? I mean, that makes no sense.
I know the data suggests what you're saying, right? But do you think personally, with everything else, that it's more likely to be an odd natural thing or a normal alien structure?
I'm completely agnostic. I would say in terms of probabilities ahead of time, without looking at the data, just if someone told me we found the first interstellar object, obviously I would say natural, no doubt about it. And a decade ago, I wrote the first paper, the only paper that was written back then in 2009, that was with Amaya Moro-Martin and Ed Turner. 2009, we wrote a paper that predicted how many interstellar rocks should we see, asteroids. And that was the only paper that was written at the time on predicting such objects. And we predicted far fewer. Now, so it shows you that, you know, my psychology was obviously that natural things are the only thing, are the only game in town. But when this object appears to be so strange, that's, I have to point this out. And that's my duty as a scientist. I don't see that as anything else. But I would be very relieved and I would be happy if it turns out to be natural. But then, of course, I said also that even if it's natural, I don't think it's likely to be an outlier, because the very first thing you see cannot be, I mean, statistically speaking, should not be an outlier. And that means that we don't understand something about the origin of this population of objects. There is a new origin that we haven't figured out, and it's not the standard, you know, ejection of objects from the outer Oort cloud of a planetary system the way we envision it. So right now, you know, the image, the mental image that I had when I wrote this paper in 2009 was, you know, there are very loosely bound the Oort cloud objects, asteroids, and they get easily ripped apart from stars, and those are the interstellar objects that we see. But it's not as simple as that, because this object looks very different than any other asteroid, and the number is much larger. And so, you know, let's try and figure out what it is, but it's not the standard picture.
The funny thing is that right from the minute we spotted it almost a year and a half ago, maybe longer, there's been a bit of a back and forth in the scientific community. Is it an asteroid or is it a comet? Comets have these highly elongated orbits, which is kind of what this thing has. But then if it's a comet, then most comets have some kind of, you know, they have their own, you know, they move independent of the sun's gravity because they have some kind of outgassing. They have some, you know, they're throwing off material in some shape. And we haven't seen that from Oumuamua. So then it's an asteroid. But then if it's an asteroid, it has a highly eccentric orbit. So how's it doing that? So that's why there's been.
Could it be
because
of its shape? Could that be contributing to the strange readings?
Not enough in terms of why it's speeding up the way it is. Okay. So yeah, there's definitely some irregularities. There are some questions, and there's a bit of back and forth. But to me, to go from, you know, oh, here's some slightly peculiar things to, oh, yes, the plausible answer is alien shield. I think it's a step too far. And I think, I mean, the thing is, I have no problem with scientists talking about this kind of stuff and saying these kind of things. But the problem is when it becomes headline news across the world, you know, Harvard physicists say maybe alien shield, you know. But this kind of stuff, when you don't give enough caveats and you don't say this is one plausible explanation of many for this one thing that's slightly peculiar.
So
I don't
think
it's responsible.
You're not arguing with the science they've done?
No, absolutely
you're
not.
Kind of not arguing necessarily with the paper that they've put together.
No.
You're arguing with the way that it's been dealt with in the press.
It's not just that. It's also the way that they have put it towards the press. You know, it's not, in this case, you know, I mean, I know that I am the press, but I'm always quite happy to be like, oh, what nonsense, they've you know, we've covered this so badly. But this is not that kind of case. I think here the press has covered it exactly as the researchers and the research institute and the journal put it forward as, which is, woohoo, could be aliens. And I think it's also, the thing is that they've looked at it, and because of these irregularities about the shape and how it's moving, they've come up with this answer. But then it's these two data points that they're then going with and saying aliens, but completely, you know, sort of no one seems to be mentioning the fact that the minute it went past, Avi, who is also part of the Breakthrough Listen project, and a lot of people at SETI, got quite excited about it, and we scanned it in every single, you know, is it sending out any kind of signal? You know, is there any kind of radio wave? Is there any kind of light wave? Anything coming from it? And the answer was no.
Yeah.
Silence. There was nothing. So how about, you know, where was the sort of calculations put in where they said, well, that takes away, you know, that makes it 10% less likely to be aliens.
Yeah.
So it was things like that. And I think I'm completely not debating the theory or the science or, you know, the fact that what they said is absolutely accurate and well within the scientific process. But at the same time, there is a lot of external information that to them might be very obvious, but to the larger public just isn't.
Hmm.
And they can't be expected to know the difference. You know, I didn't know the difference 8 years ago before I became a science journalist. I would have been completely excited and happy and been like, woohoo, aliens!
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm just a bit like, Occam's razor, everybody! Yeah. Occam's razor!
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think right now there's such an important conversation going on about trust in the media. And, you know, there's so many people claiming that the media cannot be trusted, and with this awful debate around fake news, etc. I think it's really important to be measured in how we put things out, especially things like this that could be misconstrued.
Okay, right. But I'm going to just say some words to you, which are Rendezvous with Rama. Okay. Now, in the Arthur C. Clarke story, Rendezvous with Rama, we do all this. We observe this cigar-shaped thing that comes through the solar system. We scan it for radio waves. We don't see anything. And it's only when we land on it that we discover what it is. And Andreas Heim is the lead scientist on Project Lyra, the proposed mission to send a spacecraft to Oumuamua.
So what you want to send to Oumuamua is essentially instruments for doing scientific measurements. And when we did our study, it turned out that it's very important to send a telescope to Oumuamua. And the reason for this is that Oumuamua is a very dim object, so it doesn't reflect much light back. So there have been different hypotheses why this is the case. So maybe it seems to be that the surface has been degraded by interstellar radiation over, like, ten thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, and that might be the reason why the object appears like dimly reddish, actually. So detecting the object Oumuamua at very far distances from the sun is quite a challenge because it's so dim, so you can't actually see it. And that's the reason why you need a telescope on the spacecraft in order to detect Oumuamua once you are close by. And you can do some calculations, and the telescope needs to have size of, you know, like 50 to 1 meter in diameter. But it's possible to develop such telescope for spacecraft. But that's like the most important instrument. And then obviously you can do these optical observations in optical range. But then you can also think about taking images like in the infrared or other spectral bands. Another interesting idea was if you are really able to, like, rendezvous in a kind of precise manner, or roughly precise, you could actually send an impactor. You can shoot an impactor from your main spacecraft to Oumuamua. The impactor would hit Oumuamua and then generate a cloud of dust particles. And then your main spacecraft could actually fly through this dust cloud, and then actually collect some of these dust particles, and then find out about the composition, interior composition of Oumuamua, which could be very interesting. Yeah.
Hmm. So it'd be a very bad thing to do if it was an alien spaceship, though, wouldn't it? I mean,
yeah, exactly. But you would probably know in advance if it would be an alien spaceship, because you take some pictures from a distance, and then if it's something sensitive, then yeah.
Well, what do you make of the stories this week with the, you know, the Harvard scientists and stuff? What do you make of that?
I think it's a very interesting hypothesis. And at this point, because we only have limited data from the object itself, I think it's legitimate to also propose hypotheses that are like outside of classic hypotheses that have been forwarded to date, which were mostly like, okay, is Oumuamua an asteroid? Is it a comet? So I think it's legitimate to propose hypotheses that are outside of the scope of classic astronomy. But obviously the further data might tell if this hypothesis is valid or not.
You've proposed this as an idea. Mm-hmm. You want to get people excited about it. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they be excited about it? How does it go from that to being an actual mission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very good question because I think until about 10 years ago, I would have said that, okay, the only way forward would be to excite the scientific community about this and then getting this to primarily at NASA to get it into like a decadal survey. And then once on the decadal survey, it's like the planning for the next 10 years, then it would be like competing with alternative missions. And then, yeah. And then at that point, it would already be like too late. But we find more interesting, and this is a more recent development, is that there are also private organizations or sometimes foundations that work towards actual space missions. I mean, one of them is like the Breakthrough Initiatives, for instance, but you can also imagine other foundations, organizations funding such missions, and they are much more flexible because they don't have to go through this like 5-10 years negotiation process. And maybe a way to go is to get these organizations interested in it and then committing funds to developing such a mission.
Whatever happened to that star that allegedly had a Dyson sphere around it?
Yeah, turned out it wasn't Dyson sphere. So Tabby star, that's what you're talking about, and it turned out that basically we're now pretty sure it either is in the process of forming a planet or it has ripped apart a planet or a comet, and there's a big amount of sedimentation around the star, so it's covered in lots of bits of rock. That's it.
Okay.
This is a
not
thing.
A fleet of solar powered.
Hang on, but again,
satellites.
that's only what we think it might be. That's not he's saying it might only be aliens, but that's a more plausible thing, right?
Yes, a much more plausible thing. And I think I must admit I can't remember right now what the last update on that was, but I think pretty much everyone did agree that that was most likely until, say, we get the James Webb Telescope and we have a better look at it. I think that is, you know, and I think if I remember correctly, Avi also had a paper out about that star also saying aliens. Now, I feel for him because I would love to know, to have the proof for extraterrestrial life, especially highly advanced extraterrestrial life, which would be the case in both of these cases. I'd love to have that proof in my lifetime, but I think it's so important to not.
I've seen him recently. In his defence, I thoroughly enjoyed talking to him. I found him in totally rational. Very sensible chat.
I'm not saying he's
not. No, I know. I just want people to know that. We need to state it, I think. Because when you talk about aliens, it could sound like we're just going, he's a crackpot, and he isn't. You know, he's saying that you shouldn't just say it's crazy if you say it's aliens, because it is possible that it could be aliens, you know, and it could be an alien. It's possible, right?
Yes,
it is possible.
Yes, it is possible.
And so he should be able to say that without being pilloried. And that's a fair point, I think.
Yes, I think, yes, I'd agree with you. But it's also very naive, I think, in a sort of very idealistic. That's assuming that everyone on the planet has the sort of scientific acumen and sort of can weigh in the balance of fact well as he can.
And the evidence is that they can't, right?
Exactly.
Someone who doesn't have the scientific knowledge is Ty. Ty, hello. Tell us about First Man.
I see the moon. The moon sees me. Down through the leaves of the old oak.
The vehicle's not safe.
We need to fail. We need to fail down here so we don't fail up there.
Please let the light that shines on me.
Neil, everyone's in agreement. We'd like you to command.
Shine on the one I love.
Mom, what's wrong?
Nothing. First Man is your dad's gone to the moon. The latest film from Damien Chazelle, the incredibly young and talented director that directed Whiplash and La La Land. And this is his adaptation of the biography First Man, The Life of Neil Armstrong by James R. Hansen, which I haven't read yet, but I hear is great. It's a great winning endorsement from James Lovell on the front. First Man is essentially the story of Neil Armstrong. It's not a traditional biopic. It doesn't start with where he was born and how he died. It's the life of the role of Neil Armstrong in the Apollo program, from when he's recruited as part of the next nine to landing on the moon. And in that way, it's a very unconventional film, because when people I know who've seen it, some of them didn't like it because they were expecting a very straightforward, here's the story of the Apollo 11 mission, like Apollo 13 or like any historical film. But this is a film that looks at that mission through the eyes of a man who was simply an engineer. He's not this iconic he is an iconic historical figure, but at the heart of this man, it was just someone who was all about the engineering and was also suffering a very strong personal loss, and what he goes through personally as part of this mission. So it's very unconventional, but it's very moving, and I loved it. And it has knocked some people for probably its less linear storytelling and portrayal of the Apollo 11 mission, but it's really a story of one man's mission, and it's not about the bigger historical context. It's not about the context within the Cold War. It's why this man would want to go. Mm-hmm. And much has been said about Neil Armstrong and how he's not a great storyteller. He never really conveyed like the joy and wonder and of going to the moon. For him, it was just a job that had to be done. He was just there about the engineering. And in many ways, that's kind of who you wanted to go. Mm-hmm. You don't want someone who would be dining off it for the rest of their life. You have a feeling that if Buzz Aldrin had been the first man on the moon, he would never have shut up about it. Mm-hmm. He would have been opening car showrooms. and he does that. Well, he does a lot of things. He appeared in the third Transformers film, for God's sake. Yeah. But I loved it. And Justin Hurwitz scores amazing.
God, yeah.
Hurwitz, The Landing. The Landing is a track.
I wanted to mention that. The theremin thing was really cool. You know why they put the theremin in, right? Because it turned out that it was Neil's favourite instrument. So the composer learned how to play the theremin after they found that out, and then they ran it throughout the score.
Amazing.
So I was I love it, but why theremin?
Yeah, he took theremin music on the spacecraft, didn't he? Yeah. And do you know what piece of music classical piece of music he took? No.
Clair de Lune.
No. New World Symphony.
What, the Hovis advert?
Yeah.
That one.
It wasn't then, though.
That's
I think so, yeah.
What's it called?
Yeah, that's a New World Symphony. But if you...
That's what the track's called.
It's not. It's called the Hovis advert.
And yeah,
if you, but listen to that,
okay,
and think about Neil Armstrong on the moon. It's a lot better than thinking about a Hovis advert.
That Hovis advert was directed by Sir Ridley Scott.
Was it?
Yeah. There's your random...
just making things
no,
up?
No, that is true. Ridley Scott directed that Hovis advert.
What was going on in his life at that point?
They like, both started out directing adverts. Tony Scott only got the job of directing Top Gun because he had directed a TV advert where a Saab is racing a fighter jet.
What was and it this takes TV off. For?
And advert. Paramount were like, well, this guy's got experience filming jets.
Yeah.
Let's give him Top Gun.
Yeah.
There you go. That's some useful trivia for all of you. Enjoy.
That's great.
This is why do you think I went on Pointless?
Oh yeah! Did everyone see Ty win Pointless?
Hello, I won Pointless. £500 has gone on a new TV.
You lied on Pointless. You said it was going to replenish your savings
to buy a TV.
Yeah, to buy a TV. Don't worry. I have plans to once again be on TV in a quiz. Really? Forum to refill my bank account. Yeah,
cool.
I'll find out in a couple of weeks. The cast is astounding. Corey Stoll is Buzz Aldrin's great. Pablo Schreiber crops up for 5 minutes as Jim Lovell. Carl Chandler's in it. Kieran Hines. It's just an all-star cast. Ryan Gosling, of course, is great as Neil Armstrong, just playing him as this stoic, you know, very stoic man. There's emotion bubbling on the under the surface, but he never let it show. And I think in that way, everything I've read about Neil Armstrong, Ryan Gosling nails, and Claire Foy's great as his wife Janet, and the way it just kind of conveys that, you know, going to space is dangerous. Lots of astronauts died before we even left orbit, and I think the film does a great job in conveying that, and I hope it wins a lot of Oscars.
Yeah. And I don't think it's done incredibly well at the box office.
No, it cost about $50 million, and so far it's done about $93 million.
Okay.
And they say if you, for a film to be in profit, it's going to make double back its production cost. A lot has been attributed to the whole, it doesn't show the Stars and Stripes being planted on the moon, and obviously certain political figures made a lot of hay with that. And some people have attributed it to that. And other people have just, you know, that its unconventional storytelling methods might have put some people off.
Yeah.
I personally found it great.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
I imagine it will do well in the awards season, and it will be back on cinemas then, and loads of people will go and see it.
Yeah.
Tushna.
I wasn't 100% sure about this. I was a bit worried. I couldn't quite imagine how Damien's previous track record would lend itself to taking on something like this. I was quite worried that I'd get too drawn into inaccuracies or things that they haven't got right and things like that, like I did with Gravity, which I really didn't enjoy. I know. So I was kind of
get out of the shed.
So I was a bit nervous, but then I was also really interested to see this because I think, like Ty mentioned, Neil Armstrong is such an interesting figure. He's such a, you know his name. Everyone on this planet knows his name, you know, metaphorically speaking. But he's always been quite shrouded in mystery. And I really wanted to know more about him. I wanted to see his perspective on all of this. And I'm not a big one for reading long biographies, even if they're really well written and about really interesting people. So I was all for this. And it surpassed every expectation I had. I loved it. It was, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes of me at the edge of my seat, kind of, you know. And the funny part is there were so many minutes where again, like Ty said, they did so well at portraying just how dangerous it was and just how lucky, in a way, they got that they managed to get up there so quickly with only the number of people that died, not a lot more casualties, in that, you know, I know that they're going to make it up there safely. I know that they get there and I know that they get back. Mm. But there were parts where I was like, oh my God, is it all going to fall apart? You know, kind of going, Tushna, you know that they're fine. Jesus, calm down.
That's the thing, though. I mean, we know the story, but I saw it with my wife and she had no idea about, you know, how close they were to running out of fuel,
right,
landing. And it's because the designated landing spot, it was just covered with boulders.
Exactly.
And Neil had to make the decision that they were still going to land, but it had to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
And, you know, literally they had 2% of fuel left when they landed. And my wife, I'm a big space nerd, and she's probably heard me bang on about this stuff loads of times and clearly wasn't listening because she had no idea what was going to happen with Gus Grissom, Ed White and Roger Chaffee. And, you know, when they're introduced and he goes, hi, I'm Ed White, you're like, oh no, Ed.
I know,
Ed.
Exactly. And so
when the Apollo 1 fire inevitably happens, she was shocked. And I was like, what did you think? It was Gus Grissom. She's like, I thought that's who Ed Harris plays in Apollo 13. I was like, that's Gene Kranz. Come on. She's like, I don't know, you big nerd. And so she, for her, it was revelatory. Especially with finding out about astronauts like Elliot C, who crashed his jet onto the roof of a hangar in bad weather. And, you know, most people know about the Apollo 1 tragedy, but just the number of astronauts in America and Russia that died just through sheer kind of trial and error.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
It is. I often think about if they were doing the Apollo missions now, would we have allowed it to go ahead after those deaths? And I just don't think it would have happened.
Well, but that's why we're not doing it now. That's literally why the space program. I mean, this is something that, you know, I mean, this is where I guess you could say that maybe having more context and historical background and knowing the impetus of the Cold War. And I mean, they do go into that a little bit. There is the sort of, oh, Russia's beating us at every point, but at least there were no sort of funny sort of sudden cut to a Russian space program where they're all cheering or something like that. But, you know, so they give you a little bit of that. But that impetus that the Cold War had, I mean, let's be honest, that whole mad rush was just, that's what it was. It was who's going to get there first. Mm. You know, they got into outer space. Well, damn it, we're going to get to the moon.
Especially considering that Apollo 8 was the end of 1968. And it was December. Exactly. And then between that, and that was just doing an orbit of the moon and coming home. So between that, they had Apollo 9 and 10, which was making sure you could get to the moon and detach it, and then detach the lunar lander, and then essentially doing a dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
So two more missions to the moon that most people don't really remember. they're always brushed over. So there was Apollo 8, skip to Apollo 11, forget about 9 and 10.
We have a goal for main engine.
I'm going to say something controversial, but before I do, I'm going to say that I really, really, really loved the film. I think it's incredibly beautiful. It looks like the Apollo era.
Yeah.
The way it's just gorgeous. And it says on that massive poster that Ty's given us, it says see it in the biggest screen you can, and I did see it in the biggest screen that I could, and wow, it's incredible.
Oh, the Gemini 8 mission when that goes wrong with Neil and Dave Scott.
Yeah.
That's insane.
And there's no CG, there's no green screens.
This is the thing, I couldn't believe that they did it with no green screen or blue screen, and that, you know, it was all 16mm and 35mm apart from the bits of the moon that were in IMAX.
Yeah.
Right? And that was crazy that all of that, they built the sets, which of course I love because it's going to send all those conspiracy theory nutjobs. Look, they can do it. But even in that, in those bits, and I kind of looked into this because I thought, how did they do it? That they literally, you know, found a quarry somewhere in Nevada, I think. It's always Nevada, isn't it? And you know, built the moon sets, and then they literally built these giant LED lights like tens of meters across to simulate the sun. It was even that part, you know, it was like, and I think Damon kept saying that they wanted to keep any kind of special effects to the minimum because really it was as much as you could be in that time, in that period.
That huge LCD screen.
LCD screens, they're facing it.
That's right.
And they've got, I assume that's actual footage from the International Space Station that they've kind of showing on this massive screen, and then they've got the spacecraft in front of it. And brilliant filmmaking, absolutely wonderful. And I learned today that because I think the moon landing sequence is incredible. And when they were doing it, Ryan Gosling had the actual Capcom in his ears.
Oh, from the... because I think they used the actual audio. Yeah.
But then he had that with Neil's taken out, so he was coming down the steps and he's got the actual Capcom thing. And, you know, Ryan Gosling's talking about that, and you can feel that was a special moment for him. And he actually said it on set as well, because, you know, he had the visor on, so you couldn't tell. But... And I say this with a proviso, because I'm going to watch this film probably 100 times for the rest of my life, right? But on the first watch of it, I would have liked to have seen a little more humanity from Neil Armstrong, because I think there's a lot more humanity in Neil Armstrong than the general press give him credit for and than we see in this film.
I agree with you.
I disagree in that I think you see a lot of humanity in Neil Armstrong. Such as when the Apollo 1 crew die, and when they go to the funeral and he has to leave because it's reminded of his daughter, and he's telling you know, his fellow astronauts, he just wants to be left alone.
Yes.
And for, I think for the man that Neil Armstrong was, that's him showing a lot of emotion.
but
the humanity of, you know, leaving his daughter's bracelet on the moon.
Ah.
I think that, even though that's probably just made up for the film, that probably didn't happen, we don't know. But I thought that was incredibly moving. And for a man who everyone just says was, you know, as straight as an arrow, kept everything internalized, I thought moments like that did humanize him at all. And I don't think it would have done him or the film justice to kind of have these other moments in.
I take that. Maybe I shouldn't have said given him humanity, but given him joy, given him happiness, because he was. When you watch interviews with him,
yeah,
he's got a cheeky smile on his face.
That's absolutely, absolutely
awesome. A lot of the time.
And it's, so if you read the book First Man, there's a lot of photos, there's a lot of lovely archive photos, and in a lot of them, he's got this really cheeky grin.
Yeah.
He's got this really sort of, almost like this sort of, if only you know what I know, kind of grin on his face after a couple, and even after a couple of the rather failed missions, he's posing next to a slightly burnt plane with a bit of a grin. He's a bit cockier than I think Ryan Gosling portrayed him. And there were a few moments, of that where he had that sort of, you know, slightly smarmy grin, or he found something funny in that. And I think maybe a little bit more of that, you know, maybe, the scene just before he leaves where he and Janet really get into it, where she insists that he has to talk to his children.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, that handshake that he had with his older son, I was like, oh my God, I really hope that's not historically accurate.
I don't know.
Because if
he really
shook the hand of his 11-year-old son.
These are all military men. All their kids are going to military school.
This is true.
The 60s. I wouldn't
say
that would be rare with these guys.
We were talking about that after the film, actually. I was talking about it to Kate. Kate. Is friend of the shed.
She'll be on it one day.
And she and I were saying that, you know, maybe it is really, because even that wonderful, it's poignant, but it's also a ridiculous scene, when they have just landed on the moon, and I'm thinking, God, they've got a hug now. He and Buzz have got to have, like, one hug. They've literally just landed on the moon. They are the only two people on this little piece of rock.
Yeah.
You know, the only person right now sort of more alone than them is, of course, Collins, but, you know, and they had another nice arm shake.
I think that's more like... From everything I've ever read about Buzz and Neil, I'm sure they were great as a team. I don't think they were ever friends.
No.
Do you know what I think it is? Right? I think the film makes total sense. It begins with that amazing scene, and then you get the
little cameo from Chuck Yeager.
Yeah. And then you get the horrendous death of his daughter. And that then overshadows the rest of the film. And that is brilliant, and it works incredibly well. But there are just moments of Neil Armstrong that I know of, like, and this doesn't happen in the film, it's not part of the film, but they could have chosen these moments to put in just to show his joy of...
Maybe, but that's not the story they're telling.
No,
they're storing
totally.
About from his daughter, how that runs through.
I think that's
so
what
might,
I'm saying.
That might have detracted from it. And there are many ways you could have told this story.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could have done it more of a team thing, you know, with Collins as the Joker and Neil Moore as the straight arrow and Buzz just being Buzz. But I think Damien Chazelle said he wasn't really much of a space kid growing up, and was just reading about the man rather than the mission that made it more appealing to him.
Yeah.
And I think it was a wonderful way of telling the story. There are going to be many more films made about the Apollo 11 mission. And like I said, the Apollo 11 chapter of From the Earth to the Moon is a great portrayal of the Apollo 11 landing. That's probably more done in the traditional story sense than probably most people are expecting First Man to be like. But I think the way that this story was told and the decisions behind adapting the book, the biography... I think it was really great. And
yeah, no, I agree. I agree completely. What I would say is anybody who wants to know about the other side of Neil Armstrong, look at the transcript of Neil and Buzz on the far side of the moon when they're not in contact with Earth. Neil and Buzz are on the spacecraft with Michael Collins and they're telling him about what happened on the moon. Look at that. There's a huge amount of joy. There's a huge amount of happiness there. Look at his. Look at what he said when he was in the Mercury program and he's in space on the Mercury program. His quote there wasn't, one small step for man. It was, boy, let's go. You know, this is a man who's loving what he's doing. And I think just a moment for, as a space nerd who loved the Apollo missions, I would just like to have seen one moment of that, I'm loving this space thing, you know, just one.
Maybe, but I think.
But that's just picking.
The magnitude of what they're trying to tell.
Exactly. Yeah.
If they'd just kind of landed on the moon after almost running out of fuel, and he's like, "Yeah, nailed it."
Yeah.
Right. So we've got. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, I was going to say that one thing that really intrigued me was the daughter's bracelet thing. You know, I thought it was beautiful and poignant, but I was almost like, how real is this? And it immediately triggered in me flashbacks for Interstellar and The Watch, and I was like, oh, was he really inspired by that? So I kind of looked it up afterwards. And the really interesting thing is that it's very likely that he did do it in reality.
Astronauts all have personal items that they can take.
Absolutely. So. I think they're like pilots, and they're actually probably in some ways quite superstitious people. And let's be fair, of all the missions that have ever been flown, that was one on which, you know, you superstition is allowed and it's fine. You're kind of praying to the gods whether you believe in them or not, kind of thing. And I think it was beautiful. And before much earlier, when they had that publicity thing, and Buzz Aldrin's talking about the bits of jewelry that he's going to take, his wife's jewelry that she wants him to leave up there and things like that. And of course, I think all the bits that Buzz took are documented. And you know, for each one of the astronauts later on, all of them, there's bits that they did leave, etc. But there is this idea that Neil did most likely take, it might not be a bracelet or anything like that, but he did leave some memento. And this is not just James Hansen, his biographer, saying that. His biographer said that after talking to his sister and to Janet, and none of them sort of confirmed it 100%, because maybe none of them really know, but they're quite convinced that there was something.
There were 10 minutes. Do you know this?
Yes.
Sorry. Ten minutes on the moon when he wasn't in radio contact, and during that 10 minutes, yes, he walks over to the edge of the crater.
Exactly. So I think, yeah, it's beautiful, and I love to think that it is real. And you know, even though I was completely willing to give that poetic license to Hollywood, it somehow makes it even more special to think that maybe he did do it, and there is a little memento to his beautiful daughter somewhere on the moon. Shine on the world
ever. Now, do you know who came back? Well, he didn't come back. He's in Singapore, and he's done a poem. It's Ben.
Hello. When Andrew asked me to write a poem to accompany the film First Man, I was a little daunted at first. It's a very intense film, and I think it does a fantastic job of making something that might seem quite familiar, new and weird and terrifying. So there's that, and the sort of magnitude of what the film's talking about. Plus, it's got a poem by Gil Scott-Heron as part of the film. So yeah, all that was a bit off-putting, but the film definitely stayed with me. I wouldn't say I particularly enjoyed it while watching it, but it definitely stayed with me. And the side performances, I think that's one of the joys of this kind of film, is those little glimpses of the other astronauts who are kind of the side characters, but obviously hugely accomplished, brave, amazing people in their own right. People like Gus Grissom and Ed White, played in this film by Shea Whigham and Jason Clarke, and particularly stood out was Deke Slayton, sort of chief astronaut at the time, played in the most Kyle Chandler-ish of fashions by Kyle Chandler. Perfect role for Coach Taylor. And so, yeah, this poem was inspired by those people. And it's called The Deke Slayton Memorial Space and Bicycle Museum. And I was listening to Cat Power while I was writing it. So you have to sort of imagine quite a slow, dreamy sort of sea shanty, something like that. When I go, take me to an island off Long Beach. Dress it up with Disney trees, towers to the future we designed, concrete curves screening the future we unearthed. While we're here, watch the races in Shelbyville. Tune your radio to the shortest hours, the saddest moments. Throw your wristwatch to the dust on the drive home. When we're gone, follow the red rails to Sparta, passing our schools, crossing our bridges, for a glimpse of the hollows above, our bodies still falling towards them.
Thanks, Ben. Now, this whole podcasting thing started for me many years ago in my camper van. The podcast didn't exist, and Alan Bean, the fourth man to walk on the moon on Apollo 12, came to the UK to Pontefract in Yorkshire. And I thought, I want to meet him.
Why Pontefract in Yorkshire?
Because there's a wonderful thing up there called Space Lectures.
Oh, okay.
And that's why, basically. And I thought, I really want to meet Alan Bean. So I sent an email and said, please can I interview Alan Bean? I do a podcast, which was a lie. And they
invented a podcast.
And they alarmingly emailed me back quite soon afterwards and said yes. And I thought, well, that's very, very exciting. I didn't think that's very, very exciting. I ran around my house several times shouting, I'm going to meet Alan Bean, right? And what it said in the email was, you have one question and one question only. And I was like, that's brilliant, because I don't know how to interview people and I just want to meet him. This is just an excuse to meet him. So as it got closer to the thing, I got more emails from these people, really strictly one question, right? On the day, an email and a phone call, really strictly one question. I arrive at primary school in Pontefract, outside the... You imagine a primary school library, right?
Yeah.
All the tables are small with tiny chairs. I'm standing outside the primary school library in Pontefract, and there's three people standing by the door. You've got one question. You go in, you sit down, you ask your question, you come out. I'm like, that's fine, you don't know. I'm not like... So they open the door, and at the far end of this, which isn't very far because it's the children's library, children's library, is Apollo astronaut Alan Bean sitting on a tiny chair in a children's library. I'm led over, and the person says to him, this is Andrew, and Andrew, this is Alan Bean. And Alan Bean said, hello, Andrew. And I said, hello. I can't remember what I said. Right? Yeah,
and, do you address him as Commander?
I can't remember what I said.
Did you curtsy?
And the guy, so the guy said, you know, whoever it was said, Andrew's got one question, and then he's leaving. And Alan Bean said, "What time am I on?" And the guy said, "You've got 45 minutes." And he said, "Well, he hasn't got one question then, has he? We've got 45 minutes. Have a seat." And I sat with Alan Bean and chatted for not all that time, so you had to get ready towards the end, for about 25 minutes. Other people came in, had their one question. And he was a wonderful human being. Sadly, we lost him this year. But Alan Bean had this experience in Apollo 12. They took off a few months after Apollo 11, and as they took off, they were struck by lightning twice, obviously survived. And Alan Bean had this experience where he landed on the moon, walked down the steps and turned towards the sun, and they all had these cameras strapped to the front of their spacecraft. He turned towards the sun. It fried the film in the back of his camera. He didn't know. He went round the surface of the moon taking photographs, got back to Earth and discovered that he didn't take any photos or didn't have any photographs. Okay. He then retired from being an astronaut and became an artist, painting nothing but the moon and the experiences that he and his friends had on it.
As I tell my astronaut friends, I'm not a scientist anymore. I'm an artist. So now that's how I think about it. And so when I'm planning a painting, usually I'm telling a story that I want to be remembered long after we're gone. And then I build little models so that I can get the lighting and everything right. And then when I start to paint them, I think about what colors I think might be good in this painting for some reason. And then I try to paint it that way. And then I have to make sure that I think it looks right. And if it does, then I just hope other people like it too. So that's what artists do. We've never seen a pond of water lilies that looked as good as Monet's water lilies. It just isn't, they just don't. Artists do something different. We've never seen, for example, to stick with Monet, I went to look at the Rouen Cathedral. It's a gray granite building. It's gray, and the sun rises all through the day till the sun sets. But he painted it all the colors that he could think of that he liked. And we like those paintings much better, believe me, than standing in front of the Rouen Cathedral and looking at it when it looks like a gray church.
I've heard you say before that one of the best things about being an artist is that it gives you a freedom that you don't get as a pilot of a spacecraft. And I wondered, if you could have that kind of freedom as a pilot of a spacecraft, what would you do with it? Where would you go?
My goodness. I guess you'd have to say where you've not been before. That has appeal. It'd be good to go into space and go back to the moon. But if the competition was between going to the moon and Mars, I would immediately say, let's go to Mars. We haven't been there. And if we had been, and then they said, well, we can go there, let's try a moon of Jupiter, I'd say, well, let's go that place see what's there. So I know that's how I think. And I think most astronauts feel that way. So someday there will be a discussion about it. I think we'll end up going back to the moon because it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And that money is always a problem
all
the time. So it's never going to be a time in the future where people can say, well, I'll spend this amount